Have you ever wondered how a story about a fast-talking con man, a guy trying to swindle a stubborn Iowa town, became an absolute cornerstone of American culture?
It is a pretty wild premise when you say it out loud like that.
Right. I mean, think about it for a second. You have a guy selling fake band instruments to kids, and he is fully intending to just rob their parents blind.
Yeah. And somehow this translates into one of the most beloved, uplifting pieces of musical theater in history. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are absolutely thrilled to have you with us.
We really are.
Today, our mission is to explore the source materials surrounding the 1957 stage musical, The Music Man. We are going to be unpacking this show's surprisingly difficult creation, its massive cultural footprint, which is crazy because it ranges from the Beatles all the way to modern Stephen King adaptations, and we'll look at why its central theme still resonates so powerfully with you and me today.
It really is a fascinating journey. Now, if you are joining us for this deep dive, you likely already know the basic framework of River City, Iowa in 1912.
But to set the stage for why this piece of art is so resilient, let's just recenter on the core engine of the plot. You have Professor Harold Hill.
The ultimate salesman.
Exactly. He arrives in town as a pure, charismatic grifter. His scheme is pretty simple: sell instruments and uniforms to the naive townsfolk under the guise of forming a boys' marching band, and then skip town on the next train.
Without actually teaching a single kid how to play a note.
Right, without teaching them anything. But the con gets derailed. He is ultimately redeemed by his unexpected love for Marion, the very strict, skeptical town librarian. And also by the profound impact he inadvertently has on her younger brother, Winthrop, who struggles with a severe lisp and deep social anxiety.
Okay, let's unpack this because the journey to actually get that story onto the Broadway stage sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It was not easy.
The creator, Meredith Willson, drew heavily from his own boyhood in Mason City, Iowa. But this wasn't just, a quick burst of inspiration. I was looking through the notes, and he actually started developing these themes way back in his 1948 memoir.
Which is such a great read.
It has the incredible title, And There I Stood with My Piccolo. But translating a memoir into a Broadway hit, that seems to have been a grueling marathon.
Marathon might actually be an understatement. He spent years agonizing over the material. He went through a major change of producers, which is always destabilizing for a show.
Oh, absolutely.
But the sheer volume of rewriting is what really stands out in the source material. He wrote almost 40 different songs for the production.
40.
Almost 40.
And he ended up cutting 22 of them.
Yeah.
Over half the score just tossed out.
Correct. Along with more than 40 distinct drafts of the script.
Wow.
When you look at that level of revision, it tells you that he was struggling to find the actual heart of the story.
I have to ask, how do you even keep track of the narrative after 40 drafts? Does it even look like the same show at that point?
Well, originally it didn't. What's fascinating here is how drastically the core emotional center changed. Early on, the musical wasn't even called The Music Man.
Wait, really?
No, it was titled The Silver Triangle.
My silver triangle.
And the emotional anchor wasn't a romance with a librarian at all. It focused on a boy named Jim Peru, who was partially paralyzed.
Oh, wow.
In some of the early drafts, he was entirely nonverbal, to the point where the townspeople actually wanted to institutionalize him.
Wait, that sounds incredibly dark for a bouncy musical comedy. How does a silver triangle even fit into a story about institutionalizing a child?
It is a jarring tonal shift from what we know today. The original plot revolved around Harold Hill trying to find an instrument that this paralyzed boy could physically play.
Which ended up being a silver triangle.
Exactly. But Wilson hit a wall with it. It just wasn't working. Then he had this incredible epiphany while reviewing a completely different song he'd written called The Wells Fargo Wagon.
Okay.
In that song, there was just an unnamed, lisping youngster singing one single verse. Wilson wrote in his memoir that he looked at that verse and realized this kid, who wasn't even a named character yet, had a certain undeniable magic to him.
So he just swaps the kids.
He thought, imagine if this lisping kid was somebody we know, a central character. He realized this youngster should be the boy with the social disability in the story rather than the paralyzed boy.
That is such a massive pivot. He basically throws out the entire premise of the Silver Triangle to build around a background character.
Yep.
Winthrop Peru is born from a single verse. The kid who is terrified to speak because of his lisp, but who unexpectedly bursts into loud, joyous song when he gets a new cornet off the wagon.
It is. And I think for you, the listener, this serves as an absolute masterclass in the creative process.
Definitely.
So often, when you are working on a massive project, whether it's writing, business, or design, you get stuck trying to force your original premise to work.
You get tunnel vision.
Right. But Wilson's breakthrough shows us that sometimes the most resonant element of your project is already there. It's just hiding in the margins. You have to be willing to completely rethink your original idea and throw away your silver triangle to find the real heart of what you are trying to say.
That is a brilliant takeaway. Don't be afraid to let the margins become the center. And speaking of margins, another detail from the source material about the creative process completely blew my mind.
Oh, the patter song.
Yes. Let's talk about the famous patter song, Ya Got Trouble. For anyone who isn't a theater kid, a patter song is essentially an early form of rapid-fire, rhythmic spoken word or rapping set to music.
Right.
Harold Hill uses it to whip the town into a frenzy over a new pool table.
It's arguably the most famous sequence in the entire show.
Right, but Wilson originally wrote it as just a really long, standard piece of spoken dialogue. He was actually considering cutting it entirely because it was just this massive, boring block of text about parents facing trouble.
Just a monologue?
Exactly. But then he read it back aloud to himself and realized the natural cadence of the dialogue sounded exactly like a lyric. He just added some musical backing chords, and suddenly one of the most iconic songs in Broadway history is created out of a monologue he almost deleted.
That kind of musical instinct is so rare. Wilson understood that human speech has an inherent rhythm. And that specific rhythmic requirement perfectly set up the casting for the lead role.
This is a great story.
When it came time to cast Harold Hill, the role famously went to Robert Preston.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Robert Preston was primarily a dramatic actor. He was not known as a great singer, and he had a very limited vocal range.
Which seems entirely counterintuitive. You are casting the lead of a massive Broadway musical. You'd think you'd want the absolute best vocalist in the room.
You would think so. But the producers were incredibly strategic. During the auditions, they had the men sing Trouble.
Oh, smart.
They knew it was the most difficult song in the show to perform, not because of the high notes, but because of its rapid-fire delivery.
Hmm.
Traditionally trained singers stumbled over it. They tried to make it sound too melodic.
They were over-singing it.
Exactly. But Robert Preston, relying on his strong acting background, made the delivery seem absolutely effortless. He treated it like an acting exercise rather than a vocal showcase. He understood the psychology of the con man, and that's why he got the part.
And what a payoff. The show opens at the Majestic Theater in December 1957, and it isn't just a hit, it is a cultural phenomenon. It ran for 4,375 performances.
Huge numbers for that time.
It swept the Tony Awards, winning 5 Tonys, including Best Musical. And I want to put that into perspective for you. It won Best Musical in the exact same year that West Side Story was nominated. It beat Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim.
It's a fascinating historical footnote because today, West Side Story is often viewed as the ultimate artistic achievement of that era.
Well, it's untouchable now.
But the critical response to The Music Man in 1957 was overwhelmingly positive. Brooks Atkinson of the New York Times called it as American as apple pie and a 4th of July oration.
High praise.
Older Kerr of the Herald Tribune was absolutely captivated by the sheer theatricality of it. He specifically pointed out the opening scene on the train. The production didn't just use sound effects. They had real smoke pouring out of the smokestack and real steam rolling along the rails right there on stage. It had an unstoppable, visceral momentum.
And that momentum carried right over into the music industry itself. The original cast recording made history by winning the very first Grammy Award ever given for Best Musical Theater Album in 1958. Plus, it spent 245 weeks on the Billboard charts.
That's incredible.
That is nearly 5 years of uninterrupted chart presence.
Beyond the awards and the charts, the original production also broke significant ground behind the scenes. Our source material notes a major milestone. In May of 1960, a woman named Liza Redfield took over as the music director for the production's final year.
This is such a cool detail.
When she stepped onto that podium, she made history as the very first woman to ever be the full-time conductor of a Broadway pit orchestra.
That is an incredible barrier to break right there in the orchestra pit of River City. Now, speaking of River City, here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, the timeline stuff.
Yes. The show is so deeply embedded in its 1912 setting. It's supposed to be this perfect, hermetically sealed snapshot of a bygone era. But Wilson actually slipped in some pretty glaring anachronisms, things that technically didn't exist yet in 1912.
The cultural references are fascinating because Quite a few of them completely jump the timeline.
I love spotting these in period pieces. For example, in the song Trouble, Harold Hill warns the parents about their kids reading a magazine called Captain Billy's Whiz Bang.
Right.
But that was a humor magazine that didn't even start publishing until October 1919. He also mentions a near beer called Bevo, which wasn't brewed until 1916.
Is it by a few years?
Oh, and my absolute favorite. He references the brilliant trumpet player Rafael Mendez. The only problem, Rafael Mendez was born in 1906, which means in 1912, this supposedly legendary trumpet player Harold Hill is referencing would have been exactly 6 years old.
It's a great catch. And it's a testament to the fact that Wilson was prioritizing the rhythm and the emotional feel of the references over strict historical accuracy. He wanted words that sounded right to a 1950s audience and evoked a specific Americana feeling.
It's the vibe.
Exactly. It didn't matter if it was mathematically correct. It mattered if it sang well. And speaking of the music taking on a life of its own, there is a mind-blowing financial fact about the show's beautiful ballad, Till There Was You.
I was hoping we'd get to this.
In 1963, a young British band decided to record a cover of Till There Was You for their album. That band, of course, was the Beatles.
Just a small up-and-coming indie group from Liverpool.
Exactly. Paul McCartney had been introduced to the song by a relative and loved the melodic structure. It wasn't rock and roll, but it translated perfectly into this smooth pop ballad style. They put it on their album with the Beatles, which was released as Meet the Beatles in the United States. And years later, Meredith Wilson's widow, Rosemary, revealed to the New York Times that her husband's estate actually made more money from the royalties of the Beatles' cover of that one single song than it did from the entire original Broadway production of the musical.
That is staggering. One single Beatles cover out-earns a multi-year Tony-winning Broadway smash hit. It just shows how deeply this music saturated the culture. And the pop culture footprint doesn't stop in the 60s. It is everywhere.
Everywhere.
Conan O'Brien has explicitly said it's one of his favorite musicals, and he wrote the legendary Marge versus the Monorail episode of The Simpsons as a direct, loving parody of the show's plot.
A classic episode.
Family Guy dedicated an entire elaborate stadium sequence to Peter Griffin singing the show's dance number, Shippoopy. Even Walt Disney Parks and Resorts pipe songs like 76 trombones into their theme parks to evoke that turn of the century Main Street USA vibe.
The character of Harold Hill himself has become a ubiquitous cultural archetype. He's the ultimate charming, fast-talking American con man. And we see that archetype used as shorthand in modern media all the time, completely separated from the musical itself.
We really do. In fact, the source material points out that former MSNBC host Keith Olbermann used to repeatedly refer to Fox News host Glenn Beck on the air as Harold Hill.
Which is quite the comparison.
And just to be incredibly clear here to you listening, we are simply looking at how the culture utilizes the art. Mm. We are staying entirely neutral here, not taking any left-wing or right-wing sides at all.
Absolutely not.
We are simply reporting this detail from the source to demonstrate how widely recognized the con man archetype of Harold Hill has become in American political discourse. Regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, commentators use Harold Hill as an immediate, recognizable metaphor for a charismatic grifter. You say the name, and the audience instantly knows exactly what kind of person you were talking about.
It is an incredibly powerful shorthand. And the cultural adaptations don't stop at comedy parodies or political metaphors. The music is apparently versatile enough to cross into completely unexpected and much darker genres.
This one blew my mind.
For instance, in 2025, the HBO Max horror series It, Welcome to Derry, which is set in the terrifying Stephen King universe, actually uses the song Ya Got Trouble as a creepy plot vehicle across multiple episodes.
From a sunny, optimistic Iowa town to a terrifying Stephen King horror prequel, talk about range. You just don't see that happen with Oklahoma.
No, you definitely do not.
Which brings us to the modern era and the show's ongoing, undeniable ability to draw a massive crowd. Let's fast forward to the 2022 Broadway revival, starring Hugh Jackman as Harold Hill and Sutton Foster as Marion the Librarian.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the 2022 revival is a fascinating case study in what audiences crave during difficult times and how that can sometimes conflict with what critics want.
Okay, lay it out for us.
This production was originally set to open in 2020, but was severely delayed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. When it finally did open, it was a massive, record-breaking commercial juggernaut.
Numbers are wild.
Truly unprecedented. In a single week in March 2022, the show took in $3.5 million at the box office. That was more than any show had made since the pandemic began.
Wow.
And its success spilled over into philanthropy, too. In the fall of 2022, it broke the all-time Red Bucket fundraising record. For anyone unfamiliar, the Red Buckets are those literal Red Buckets cast members hold at the theater doors after a show to collect donations for the charity Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS.
Right, they do that after the curtain call.
Yes. And the Music Man cast raised over $2 million.
Over $2 million just from the post-show bucket collections. Audiences were literally throwing money at this production. But I do have to point out, looking at the critical response, it was not the universal love fest that the 1957 opening was. The critics are actually pretty divided.
Yes, there was a stark divide. On the negative side, critics like Jesse Green at the New York Times were quite harsh. He declared the revival flat and felt it was strangely inward-looking.
Ouch!
He specifically criticized Hugh Jackman's dancing as lacking the necessary sharpness, and felt that while Sutton Foster gave a witty acting performance, she was vocally miscast for the traditional soprano requirements of Marion. Frank Scheck at The Hollywood Reporter also gave it a rather lukewarm review regarding the lead performances.
But then you flip the coin, and there were critics who absolutely defended it. Marilyn Stasio over at Variety gave the production a total rave review. She called it vintage Broadway, gusset up in grand, glorious style, and praised the entire cast and the direction. I wonder if the critics who disliked it were just looking for a gritty, modernized reinvention rather than a classic restaging.
I think you've hit on the core tension there. It's a classic divide between critical expectations and audience satisfaction. Critics often want to see a revival justify its existence by offering a new, challenging perspective on the material.
They want it to be edgy.
But audiences aren't always looking to be challenged. The revival was nominated for 6 Tony Awards, but it didn't win a single one. Yet, it ran incredibly successfully until January 2023.
And I think the takeaway for you, the listener, is pretty profound here. 0 Tony wins, mixed reviews from the major papers, but record-shattering financial success. It proves that coming out of the dark, isolated years of the COVID-19 pandemic, audiences weren't necessarily looking for edgy, groundbreaking, theatrical perfection.
No, they wanted an escape.
They were incredibly eager for nostalgia. They wanted the comfort, the bright colors, and the ultimately uplifting community spirit of River City, Iowa. They wanted to feel good.
Exactly. They wanted to sit in a theater, hear 76 trombones played by a massive orchestra, and leave with a smile on their face. It provided exactly the kind of communal joy and shared experience that people had been starved for over the previous 2 years.
Okay, we've covered the grueling 40 drafts, the history-making Grammy records, the pop culture parodies, and the billion-dollar post-pandemic revivals. So what does this all mean? When you step back, you see a simple story based on a guy's Iowa boyhood that was relentlessly edited, reinvented, and chiseled down until it became this indestructible cultural touchstone.
It really is.
A piece of art so strong it spans from barbershop quartets to the Beatles to Pennywise the Clown.
It is a remarkable artistic trajectory, and this raises an important question, especially when we look at the very climax of the story. Think about the final scene of the musical.
Oh.
The town is ready to tar and feather Harold Hill. He's been exposed as a complete fraud. He has absolutely no musical training.
Mm-hmm.
And Marion urges him to lead this ragtag group of boys who also have no training in playing Beethoven's Minuet in G.
Right, and it sounds terrible. The script explicitly dictates that the boys have very limited musical ability. They are just squawking, blowing through these horns. It's an auditory disaster.
They play it terribly. But the parents in the audience don't care. They are completely enraptured just by the sight of their children standing up there in uniform trying to play music together.
Yeah.
The shared experience completely wins over the angry town.
And that leads me to a final thought I want to leave you with today, looking at the very core of Harold Hill's con. Throughout the entire show, he is selling what he calls the think system.
Right, the think system.
He promises these kids that they don't need to learn how to read sheet music. They don't need to learn the technical notes. They just need to think the music, and it will magically come out of the instrument. Now, obviously, technically speaking, the think system is a total fraud. It is a complete fabrication designed to avoid doing the actual work of teaching.
Of course.
But look at the end result. It actually worked. The think system brought young Winthrop out of his shell and gave him confidence. It united a bickering, stubborn town. It brought immense joy to those parents in the gymnasium. So the provocation for you to ponder today is this. In your own life or in your career, how often do you let the lack of strict technical perfection stop you from trying something?
That is a great point.
We hold ourselves back because we don't know the exact right way to do it. But what if the sheer enthusiasm, the collective belief, and the community building of the think system is sometimes actually more valuable than knowing how to play the perfect notes? What if just putting on the uniform and blowing the horn as loud as you can is exactly what the room needs to hear?
That is a fascinating way to look at it. A beautiful, unexpected lesson from a fast-talking salesman.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking for the magic hiding in the margins of your own life, and we'll catch you next time.